Hello, hello, hello. It is... What day is it today?
Oh, it is Thursday the 6th?
Yes, Thursday the 6th, 2018. My name is Anurag Singh. This is Not Fake News on 91.7 FM, which is what you're listening to right now. It's been a week of very chaotic weather here in Austin, but it's winding down, so that's good. Anyways, joining me in the booth is Wes Dodson, co-founder of the Texas Orator and host of the KVRX show Declarations from Independence. We have Nick Romanow, foreign affairs editor for the Texas Orator, member of the Texas Political Union, and last but not least, Matthew Cox, staff writer for the Orator and host of the Longhorn Update. Yes, we are running a bit late here, but anyways, we'll have to get into it right now. So, how's everyone been doing?
I've been doing all right.
Pretty well.
It's been a good day.
Yeah, it's been kind of hectic here. I'm still trying to like set things up. My headphone thing is kind of messed up. Anyways, let's move.
How did you get that tangled like that?
Well, it was. I'll blame it on whoever, someone else. Anyways, so let's move into our first segment for the day, and of course, it is the talk of that town. In this segment, we discuss the talk of that town, which is of course the town being Washington, D.C., and this week we're discussing the Brett Kavanaugh hearings. This is the third consecutive day of hearings for Judge Brett Kavanaugh, who is Trump's nominee to replace the retiring Supreme Court Justice Anthony Kennedy. And many Democratic senators are grilling Kavanaugh on his views on abortion, gun rights, the environment, presidential power, and more. So I wanted to open it up to the panel. What do people think about Kavanaugh himself and the hearings generally? And we can start with Wes.
Yeah, so I'm going to officially petition to call this segment Swamp Talk, but we'll get to that later. So to get to the actual justice himself, I think Kavanaugh, the one thing that we can say about him is he is supremely qualified. That's going to be something that I think a lot of people can miss as we look at the news and look at the commentary from both sides about the judge. But one thing we don't want to get lost in the midst there is the fact that he is an incredibly thoughtful and logical jurist in his writings. He's very clear and expressive. He is an incredible appellate judge in terms of the way that his opinions are often become national hits almost immediately and are used by the Supreme Court. So it's someone who I think we can safely say is qualified and has the actual requirements for the position. In terms of how I feel about his positions that he's taken on in the past, I'm concerned about Fourth Amendment rulings that he's had concerning the way that police are allowed to execute warrants. And I'm particularly concerned with his views on executive authority and the expansiveness of executive authority. He exudes deference to the executive, to use the Supreme Court parlance of the past, and really sees the unitary executive as something that, or as someone that has broad and expansive powers, which concerns me, obviously, from a libertarian perspective.
I agree. I think on the face, Kavanaugh is, he's pretty well qualified for the job. He's been around, been in D.C. for a while. I am a little bit concerned that, there's a lot of contradiction, I feel like, with the belief that he's, going to be this impartial jurist. That's a little bit hard to believe when not only has he been consistently conservative throughout his career, he was also, you can safely call him a Bush administration official. He worked in a White House and was heavily involved in a lot of the policies there. So, but that shouldn't surprise anyone given that he was nominated by Donald Trump and who, uses these Supreme Court nominees to really placate the establishment Republicans. Whenever you ask a establishment Republican to explain why they continue to look the other way to all these monstrosities of policy, it's always Neil Gorsuch, Neil Gorsuch, Neil Gorsuch. So, I think Brett Kavanaugh is just the latest extension of that. And I find it interesting just to see how the Democrats will handle this. They seem to be fairly committed to getting in the way and slowing things down and trying to delay it until after the midterms. But I don't really know what their end game is after that. I don't know if they're going to try to shoot down Kavanaugh and make Trump nominate a moderate. I don't know if they want to ride out an 8-person Supreme Court for 2 more years and try to win in 2020. I don't know what they're going for here. Right now, it's a lot of noise, and I think, in short, the way I would describe the current situation is goat rodeo.
Yeah, well, I mean, let's clarify for listeners out there that that is actually not something the Democrats, I think, can really do. They don't have the numbers to block the Supreme Court pick.
Which is exactly why I don't understand what their end game is. They're doing a lot of show.
I think we're maybe attributing an end game where there might not be one, as opposed to a short-term kind of way of scoring political points. And I think if there is a strategy, it's actually focused on Kavanaugh himself, you know, to the extent that there might be an end game long term, it is to kind of weaken Kavanaugh's defenses or his confidence and potentially get him to lean a bit more liberal than he would have. You know, he hasn't faced political pressure like this in the past, or at least public political pressure like this in the past.
Well, I would disagree with that. I mean, you look at 2000, I think it was 2006 when he was being confirmed as a circuit judge when he was. What you talk about qualifications, back then he was not qualified to be a circuit judge. I mean, he was a very partisan, like you said, Bush official. And during those circuit hearings, people were like, this is crazy. Why is Brett Kavanaugh, you know, this guy who really doesn't have almost any record being confirmed in a circuit position, which was, I think, in 2006. So he has faced a little bit of political pressure in the past, and he's survived it. So, but I do want to get Matthew's view on it before we...
Yeah, it is quite interesting, and I'm not going to agree in exactly the same way, but it is questionable how straightforward he can be. It's questionable if the Democrats would be able to get a better choice off of them either, because as biased as Kavanaugh may be, especially seeing as he is a member of the Federalist Society, that's true of every other conservative judge that has also been nominated in the 21st century, and that's true of all the other picks that Trump supposedly has lined up. I mean, last time I remember, he was given a list of 12 different judges as a possibility for Supreme Court nominations, all from the Federalist Society, and so far he's, you know, gone first with Gorsuch, and he's also going forth with Kavanaugh.
Yeah,
so most likely we'd end up having another judge of the same conservative caliber. Not to say that the Federalist Society is hyper-conservative, that might be an overstatement, but to say that they're only right-leaning would be an understatement. So we're definitely going to have a bit of an issue of him being biased. I mean, that was expected, but this is a dramatic push over a Supreme Court, which has been generally a bit more progressive than it has been conservative.
Yeah, I mean, I would disagree with that. I mean, I think the Supreme Court right now is pretty right-leaning. I mean,
over the last 100 years.
Oh, okay. Well, I suppose we use that kind of metric. Anyways, what I love about every time that the Supreme Court justice is, you know, needing to be replaced, is that everyone in Washington, D.C. comes around and has this big thing about, like, oh, who's he going to pick? And, like, what's the policy here? And they ignore the fact that, like, for example, Brett Kavanaugh during his hearings was very smug about, like, oh, I'm very impartial. And, like, every question he was asked is, like, oh. For example, he was asked about what's his view on indicting a sitting president. He's like, well, I don't have a view on that. I don't have an opinion on that. And then he goes to voice his opinion on that, basically by saying that there's a memo the Justice Department has been using which says it can indict the president. And so there's always this facade with Supreme Court justices, including Scalia and all these other people, who are like, yes, they're very smart and they're very qualified, but they're also, they read the law very, like, impartially, which I think is just a kind of one of the underlying farces of, like, the entire court system, is that, like, you know, within the courts, like, you have to pretend like you're making all these legal arguments for why, for example, you can't separate kids from their parents when it comes to immigration, when in reality it's just a judge using their values to just kind of decide however they want. I mean, the Supreme Court has always been political, and so it's like, I just don't see this whole, like, obsession over, like, impartiality. And a lot of commentators are saying, like, Judge Kavanaugh is very qualified and he will interpret the law, you know, as a qualified person should, but, like, really it's about his values, and that's really the debate here.
Like all Supreme Court justices previously, he's going to interpret it according to his values.
Yes, and as for the Democrats, I mean, like I said, last week, the Republicans were able to steal basically a Supreme Court seat, getting rid of Merrick Garland and getting Neil Gorsuch in there. Democrats do not have that kind of spine, and so I don't know if... I think that for the Democrats, a good strategy would be, after Kavanaugh is confirmed, which he will be, to think about packing the court, because that's actually the only thing they can do, and they can have a very good case about, like, hey, you know that Neil Gorsuch was, like he's not supposed to be there, like, Merrick Garland's supposed to be there, and so we're gonna have a, you know, court packing temporarily, and then, like, you know, change the system so that, like, because, you know, I think it was actually proposed by Rick Perry originally, is that, like, you know, they have a system where it's, like, 18 years for every Supreme Court judge, and then, like, every president gets to pick two. And that, like, you know, that will be the long-term thing, because right now this is just by happenstance, like, the Republicans have been confirming, like, almost all the Supreme Court justices in the past, I don't know how many years.
Well, I mean, so to address those as slightly separate points, I mean, so to get to the Supreme Court packing scheme, I suppose that is something that they could float, that they certainly could not execute that. It would require a constitutional amendment, which would not be feasible.
Do you think Congress can pull off a constitutional amendment?
Well, it doesn't say nine, right? It doesn't say nine Supreme Court justices.
And that's exactly it's been different through history. I'm not quite sure about the technicalities, but I do know that there has been, it's not always been nine, it's changed throughout time, and I think it is an interesting idea to just straight up change the institution, but I worry about the repercussions of that. Is, okay, let's say Democrats come into power 2020, they carry House, Senate presidency, and then they somehow are able to push through this packing thing. Well, as soon as Republicans, you know, as soon as the table turns and the Republicans are in power, what are they going to do? Are they going to unpack the court? Are they going to pack the court? So, I mean, as I think you were saying, there has to be some sort of structural change that tries to take out bias from the courts.
Right. So I think that, like, there was a good, interesting back and forth between, I think, Tucker Carlson and some, I forget the guy's name, I'll pull it up, but someone who argues for court packing. As a liberal, he says that, you know, temporarily, I think, he said that, you know, for example, Neil Gorsuch is basically not supposed to be there. So I think the you know, Democrats have a decent case to say, like, look, we'll have, you know, one or two more Supreme Court justices that, like, we'll pick. And then structurally changing the way the Supreme Court is, like, nominated, because just by, you know, if you look at the number of elections that, like, you know, Republicans have won in the past, I think five elections, national elections, like, they've lost the popular vote a number of times, but yet they've also nominated way more justices to the court. And so, like, something is wrong there. And so I think, you know, changing the way that we nominate Supreme Court justices, like, I think Rick Perry supported this idea that, first of all, you don't have lifetime justices, you have them for 18 years, yeah, and then you have it so that, you know, every president gets to choose, every 4 years they choose two justices, and, like, they phase it out. And there's a way to do that.
Right.
And I think that's something we should look to long term, because this whole, like, the whole structure, I think, is just, it's not working.
Well, and I did misspeak earlier. The court packing itself would not require a constitutional amendment. Rather, the plan that you were proffering would require that constitutional amendment, because it does change the life term, which is constitutionally mandated.
I mean, that's something that's a lot longer term, but I think that changing the court packing is such the defense for court packing, I don't think is that, like, you know, that bad. I mean, the Republicans getting Merrick Garland there by saying we can have eight. That's fine. Eight is fine for the next however hundred many days.
Yeah, I mean, so to respond to that, I mean, I will say that the court packing scheme in and of itself, without that, you know, qualifying nature of the non-renewable 18-year term, it does seem to be problematic in many respects. It is a, you know, acting upon an institution which was voted upon in the past. So voters vote with an understanding of the Supreme Court as having nine justices in the past. And so if we're going to, you know,
I think that's a kind of a silly thing, because you can make that point to people. People say the same point about, like, when LBJ came up with Medicare and Social Security, is that, like, well, voters don't know what's going to happen. What happens when Republicans will come into power? Won't they just get rid of Social Security? Social Security's still here. So, like, every time a big change happens, people are like, what's going to happen? But, like, I think that the Democrats actually had some vision, and if they actually were ambitious like the Republicans, who are able to just throw everything up into flames if they don't want Merrick Garland.
Yeah, I mean, I want to make sure that we're not conflating these two schemes as comparable, because the law was very clear that the Republicans did have the, you know, the right to not confirm Merrick Garland. There is no incumbent obligation for the Senate to do anything in that case. They could, you're very right to say that they could sit on eight justices for as long as they chose. There's no incumbent obligation for them There might be the moral obligation or the, you know, obligation from duty, but there is no legal obligation for the Senate to act in such a situation. Whereas in the Supreme Court packing, I think we run into some very serious constitutional.
The Senate has to confirm that is something that has been, that's in the Constitution.
Well, so I mean that's a norm. That is a
they are not obligated
in any, you know, again, any particular timeline. So again, we're talking about a norm situation.
Right. And so nine Supreme Court justices. That's not something that's in the. There's no legal.
It's a norm. So what you're arguing against in terms of against the Republicans is that they have broken some long held norm, and then you're saying that the Democrats should, in theory, do the same thing, because I mean, from a legal perspective, no law was abridged, nothing was afoul, and so I'm concerned that we're, you know, fixing a wrong with a wrong.
There's a very vague the line between law and norm is very murky, because like I said, like the memo, the Justice Department memo, that's also a norm. That's not a legal thing. You know, again, so like, and Judge Kavanaugh thinks that that's a legal thing. So I guess if you, I mean, again, this is the whole thing about laws and norms. It's just so murky.
I think it would qualify as statutory law, wouldn't it?
What, the memo?
Yeah, because it's just it's passed as in, like, it's passed as in it is a previous.
I mean, I think the memo doesn't have, the memo is just, you know, it's a norm, like a norm the Justice Department has been using. Like, it's not an actual legal thing. It hasn't been, you know, legally determined. It's just a way the Justice Department has been conducting itself, in the same way the people have been conducting themselves around the Supreme Court.
I mean, it contains the same authority technically as an executive order. It's not actually law itself, but it is enforced until it is unenforced.
Okay. I think we have disagreement on that, but we have to move on. But let's get Wes's final point on that.
Yeah. So I mean, to address the memo briefly. Matthews is almost exactly correct. It is the Justice Department's, you know, opinion and longstanding opinion, both over a Democrat and Republican administrations.
Opinion, not law.
Opinion, yeah, right. But again, under the Constitution, the Justice Department is the executor, the individual, or the department that executes those laws. And so if there's an opinion that is longstanding within that, you know, department, you're right, it's not law, so to speak. But it, you know, falls under the broad penumbra of norms that do constitute. I mean, that's the thing, is we're talking about all these laws. Norms are much more incredibly powerful than laws in any situation. I mean, the reason that people don't break the law is often not because it is law. It's because there's a societal norm against it. And so,
I don't think you can conflate a societal norm with a memo of the Justice Department or a
I think you very much can, because
that is not the same thing as we should not kill people, because of,
that wasn't the norm I was referring to.
Breaking a law because of a societal norm, like I don't think you can conflate those two things.
I mean, okay, so that was potentially a hyperbolic situation. You know, I was referring to even less, you know, drastic situations. You know, there was for a long time a societal norm against drug use, and that was by far the and still is the factor that most influences non-drug users. But when we're talking about norms in the Justice Department and in politics in general, I don't think we can really make a strong distinction between societal norms and norms that exist in politics, especially with regards to this memo, which we've talked about as a norm, but which I think we have to back up and say it is rooted in strong arguments for why a sitting president cannot be prosecuted criminally. I mean, because imagine a situation wherein an executive operating in 50 states is open to criminal liability in all of those 50 states. He could be at any given time pressed upon to be in court. It would interfere with the that's the thing. We have to consider.
So okay, we're going to have to leave it there. But sure. I think that with regarding the Justice Department memo, if you believe that, you believe the president is above the law, because the president cannot be indicted for it. And Donald Trump is correct when he says he can shoot someone in the middle of Fifth Avenue and then not have any criminal
sitting president. We
yeah,
say.
I think sitting there is the operative word.
But that's ridiculous. That, I mean, if as we can see, right? That's what I'm saying. Like, the current, all my point is that I think the structures right now are very broken, because, for example, if he will be the sitting president until they impeach, and they won't impeach, and so if the president did anything illegal, we can't indict him.
No longer president by the constitutional
term. Okay, he'll just pardon himself. Why can't he pardon himself then? I mean,
he cannot pardon himself after he is not president.
Well, he can pardon himself when he is president, and then.
But you can't pardon yourself
if you don't get indicted.
If you didn't do anything.
Right.
We're getting a call. Hey, we have a caller, so we're gonna have to figure this out, because apparently, so the speaking system, the phone system doesn't actually work. So we're just gonna put the mic near the speaker. But we have a caller, so he wants to give his feedback.
I believe you called in and said you wanted to express your opinion on why our system is so broken.
Yeah. I have it right here.
Yeah. So
I don't know. All this right now that's going on, everything that's been going on before Trump, before all this disagreement and hostility, has been washed out of our perspective. Okay, it's been taken out of our eyes, but it's these lies that have been going on for 50 years, where they've been setting up corporations to lobby. They're basically getting paid to lie about the laws. Our whole system hasn't been making laws based on the truth for the past 70 years. Okay, cannabis is literally still illegal. Tell me one person you know who doesn't know for a fact that cannabis is a medicine. Okay, you live in Texas. They're brainwashing everybody there. They have a huge prison industry across all of America. We've got a prison population of 2.6 million people.
Yeah, what do you have to say about the Kavanaugh hearings?
The what?
The
Kavanaugh hearings.
Anyways, we'll have to move on. We have our next segment to get to, so thank you so much for calling in.
Yeah, that was very insightful. What's your name?
My name is Kiko.
Okay, yeah, all right. Thanks very much, and we'll keep that in mind. That is our first caller of the semester, so, you know. And I think I actually agree with a lot of what he was saying about the... he was talking kind of about the structural... you know, the problems we are having right now, and how the system itself is, there are a lot of problems with the system itself, and I think that there's a lot to say about that. But we're going to have to talk about that a different day, because we have a jam-packed week of news, and...
Are we just getting lit up here with phone calls?
Yeah.
I didn't know we had a phone number.
All right, I'm going to let Nick take that, and we're going to just keep moving on. We really don't have a system for...
It hung up. It called and hung up.
Anyways, so let's move on to the next segment, which is College Chaos, which is very aptly titled for this segment in the show, and this show generally, I think. because, of course, this segment we talk about how something happening in college right now, something that, you know, a college story, and I had to come up with something alliterative, so I came up with chaos, because college is very chaotic. Anyways, the story is about Betsy DeVos, the education secretary, who is preparing new policies on campus sexual misconduct, and there's a number of things that would happen under her new policies. I don't think that they've... Have they been...
Yeah, so we're actually awaiting publishing of the policies themselves. That was purported to be potentially as early as tomorrow, but could be into September.
And basically, the number of things that would happen... it would bolster the right of students accused of assault, harassment, or rape, and would lessen liability for institutions of higher education. The new rules also would narrow the definition of sexual harassment and would only hold schools accountable for conduct occurring on campus. And there's a number of other things. I think there's a giant New York Times article with all the different specific things about it.
Apparently, it even raises the burden of proof used by schools on adjudicate.
Yes. And so there's a number of changes that are happening, and I want to get the panel's view on it. I don't know, have I described it well, or are there other things that I need to mention?
Yeah, I mean, so I think we need to consider the actual context of it to kind of understand what's going on. So what we're looking at here is a change in the sexual misconduct and sexual assault and sexual harassment laws under Title IX. But we're not actually looking at a change in those laws so much as a change in the way that they are executed or applied by campus administration in their kind of internal investigations. And so I think to deal with the kind of thing that's going to be the big sexy headliner of this is that burden of proof that Matthew mentioned. Raising that burden of proof or giving the schools the option to raise that burden of proof from the preponderance of evidence standard to the clear and convincing. And so to think about those, preponderance of evidence is often thought of as 50 plus one or 50 plus a feather. It really just means that the charge has to be more likely than not for it to be found guilty. And then the clear and convincing is thought of as much more likely than not to be to have occurred to be guilty. So think of 75%. But to dispense with those, they're meaningless. They don't have any real application because the individuals that are handling these cases are not trained jurists. They haven't been to law school. They do not really understand how to apply those in the same way that I don't understand how to apply that. They are in kind of nonsense terms unless we are in a very clear setting of standards of evidence. And that's another big thing, is that these courts already do not operate by the same standards of evidence as a typical court, which tends to actually favor the defendant. And so when a lot of the whinging going on in the realm about how these courts disfavor the defendant is slightly is at least tempered by the fact that the standards of evidence tend to allow exculpatory evidence that would not be allowed, such as
Could you give me example? I mean, this is news to me. I thought that this was, right. I guess I've been just sort of a sheep with listening to people, but what's this?
Hearsay is certainly allowed, as well as, electronic records such as text messages. And this tends to actually go towards character or go towards could this individual have committed this crime? Is he the type of, and I use he just because the overwhelming majority of these are male against female violations. But the standards of evidence are different, such that, witnesses that were not actually present at the scene, but have heard through a friend and so don't actually provide first person evidence are allowed. So it's really about building an emotional case as opposed to a hard evidence, because oftentimes there is little to none hard evidence.
Clear, I just wanted to ask a question. Maybe Nick can answer this if he knows, but for these courts, the Title IX courts, who are the people that are adjudicating these? Are these Title IX like officials? Or Matthew maybe know about this because he's the Longhorn expert. But does anyone know about what that is?
My understanding is that these what's being outlined in the change by the current Department of Education is changes to how the university, how institutions that receive federal money, which is actually not only public schools. I believe lots of private schools also do. Just overwhelmingly universities in general. It's how those institutions manage their interactions with their students and with their employees. And so I believe that, all schools have, by now, would have their own kind of departments that would just be dedicated to adjudicating issues between students, between faculty, in relation to Title IX.
That actually tends to not be the case. For many of these campuses and many of these colleges, there is not a dedicated... There is a Title IX compliance officer who's often involved with the case, but there are often not dedicated officials that are in charge of these, such that it's not like an actual role. Oftentimes an administrative individual will just be appointed as an internal investigator for these cases. That's essentially the occurrence at UT. The Title IX individual or the Title IX compliance administrator is going to be involved, and then it will typically go to a review process in which evidence is gathered and then goes up against a panel of I want to say UT uses a tri-panel of administrators in which the case will be decided.
I think the critical difference is not so much how universities manage. I think the critical difference is the liability that goes to universities, and not so much of what happens to students and what happens to faculty, because at the end of the day, expulsions, firings, those typically that decision is made between between the individual and the university. The government doesn't really have a big role in that. The role here, I believe, the big change here is how accountable is the federal government holding universities? And I think that accountability has lessened a whole lot. So I'm really interested to see how the hierarchy shifts.
Well,
if top administrators in universities no longer feel that they had the government breathing down their neck and they're going to lose all this money if they don't make the right decision, if they no longer feel that pressure to do the right thing, I wonder how is that going to affect not necessarily the policies in paper in writing. But how is that going to affect how policies play out in practice?
Well, intuitively, you would imagine that if there's less oversight, that they would probably not have, they would not have the compulsion to actually go and investigate these cases. And that's intuitively what I'd imagine would happen. But I wanted to get people's views, like, generally about, I guess this is a very, like, we're talking about, like, the DeVos policies, but I want to talk about, like, the Title IX thing, sort of corpus as a whole, and what people's views are on that. Is it obviously, four guys talking about it, maybe that
it's never the best situation.
Yeah.
We should probably get some estrogen in the room. This is true.
This is the not fake news diversity panel.
Yes, right.
Yes, but I know of stories of people who I know, male and female, who have used Title IX in their respective universities to actually, get some justice for, I think, for example, for stalking and things of that nature, which aren't necessarily, especially here in Texas, like the rules regarding sexual harassment and rape, on the state level are very different from the university policies.
Mm-hmm.
And so I'm wondering what your views are on this, because I think there's a lot of different opinions about Title IX and as a whole.
Well, I mean, it is true that you have to, sometimes the way we at least traditionally look at cases and Title IX cases, that you look at it as being a bit of a like softer evidence file, because a lot of the evidence often isn't very hard, right? Stalking is a kind of a hard thing to prove unless he's gone, they have gone and broken into something of yours. It's kind of hard to say that, oh, I'm just being followed. It's a hard thing to prove, so it needs a little bit less evidence. But the question is, we in this country traditionally use the phrase shadow of a doubt to define how we try and how we convict people of different crimes or misdemeanors. So the question is, how do we put those two issues together?
So I think what Matthew raises is an interesting point, and what I would say to that is that I think that the reason that we have these kinds of, I think people could call it derogatively, like pejoratively, extrajudicial courts, is because these aren't really like, I don't think this, for example, for the stalking issue, there's not a criminal liability. It's really this: the university is using their power to say, okay, if you go near this person, we're going to like expel you, or we're going to suspend you. And so there's not as much of like a that's my understanding for a lot of, yeah. I guess you could call them minor offenses, but they're not really minor, like stalking and things of that nature.
Right. I mean, so we have to remember that Nick was exactly right saying that this is really about how universities manage interactions between students. And so their judicial capability, such that it exists, is to manage those interactions sexual nature that are non-consensual, that rise to the standard of harassment, that rise to the standard of misconduct or potentially even assault, should be within the purview of the university. It is something that affects the way that students can interact and can learn in their environment. And so I think we have to separate these two, or these new regulations, into two different things. One, wherein does the university actually have that authority? So the ruling suggests that they would not be held liable for sexual assault, harassment, or misconduct that is perpetrated off campus. They would not be required to adjudicate that or to follow through on any type of proceedings. They do have the option to do that. And so that's one of the things that I think we have to consider or keep in mind, that these are all technically guidance in the way that this is going to play out. And so universities are going to be slow to adopt many of these, to the extent that they have to adopt or will adopt all of them. But we have to separate that out. So I am definitely against any type of regulation that says off-campus sexual assaults can't be adjudicated by universities, because if it is student to student, it necessarily affects the way that those students interact. Mm-hmm. Oftentimes, these are people who know each other, who could potentially be within the same organizations or even in class together. And so I don't understand the regulation that says that that is not something that the university has the authority or has the obligation to follow through on, as well as loosening or relaxing the standards of what constitutes sexual harassment and misconduct. There have been problems with the way that those are defined, but that tends to be at a university level. And so the University of Texas, for instance, actually does have a very, I think, sound, policy in its handbook for the way that it defines it. And it is about the disparate impact on that individual. So whether or not you are stalking that person physically, if you're online stalking them, and it can be quite clear that it is detracting or detractionary to their study process, to their life in general, you are guilty of that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, it's interesting. I mean, it's just so remarkable that, especially in this climate with the whole Me Too movement, that, you know, DeVos and other Trump people would be loosening the requirements and thinking that we're being too harsh on defendants. I mean, I think that that's what we're seeing now. I mean, this is a very kind of philosophical point, but like what we're seeing now is that like a lot of this stuff is, you know, we've seen, you know, a lot of people have been victimized for sexual harassment, misconduct, and things of that nature. So it's interesting. Mm-hmm. And yeah. I think Wes made a very good point about the on versus off campus distinction, which is completely arbitrary because, like you said, the university has a responsibility, I think,
right,
because students are going to the same place. They're going to the same classes, being the same place.
I mean, because we have to understand that the reason they have this authority at all to begin with is because of the way that it affects students' interactions. And if it happens off campus, if it happens on campus, both of those can have incredibly negative impacts on the way that students interact, the way that they learn. And so I you know, piece that out and I am totally against that.
I absolutely agree with Wes. But I would also add the point that I think that the burden here to hold universities accountable to make sure that they are doing what they need to do to protect students and protect education, that accountability, I believe, needs to come from the state governments. If federal government is not going to do the job, it's through the state legislatures that most universities receive their charter, public universities. And most education regulation happens at the state level. And so I believe that if we're going to hold universities accountable, I think it's the state governments that need to step up. And this is something we've been talking about a lot, is what, you know, people like to overlook local and state politics and always focus on national politics. I think this is an arena that's incredibly important, that, you know, there's a huge population of college age students in the U.S., and
so wouldn't you say that at that point, sorry to interrupt you, but like wouldn't you say at that point that it becomes a matter for the federal government to go and have at least some general guidelines, especially when it comes to something like harassment?
I'm not agreeing with the idea that the federal government should loosen their standards. I'm saying that in light that now that the federal government has forfeited the responsibility, instead of just sitting and pointing and say DeVos this, DeVos that, I think that we need to lobby our state governments to fill that void.
I mean, the problem with that is that the states are really rather impotent in the way that they can actually execute on that power, because these will end up in federal court, because the judges are required to rule on these federal guidelines. And then we should note that as opposed to President Obama's Dear Colleague letter, these are going to be judiciable. Wow. In court, they're going to be held to that standard. And so states, I mean, you're exactly right that states should do as much as they possibly can, which is going to largely involve pressure from their politicians in terms of funding and whatnot. But in terms of how they can actually get the universities to fall in line on these guidelines, it's very difficult, because these do so often end up in federal court, and those judges are required to go by the federal guidelines. And so it's a very difficult situation for states to be in.
And additionally, there's this thing about, like, also, if you leave a lot of this up to the states, like, it can be really problematic, because if a student goes to a university in Alabama and, like, the harassment, you know, think regulations are different from if they were to go to Texas, like, that just seems just intuitively doesn't make much sense.
Right.
So there is a role, I think, that the federal government should play, but Matthew wanted to say something. Also, I think we're going to be cutting the last segment of the, on Palestine.
Right.
We don't have enough time to talk about Palestine and Israel right now.
Slightly off topic, but I do, with the fact that this is a federal guideline, and I do agree it should be a federal guideline, this is like one of those things that needs to be uniform across the nation. But it would be nice if the, the federal government footed a little bit more of the bill than the states did, you know, with the fact that they're imposing their own guidelines here.
Yeah, I mean, it's an interesting point. I mean, Wes, you wanted to say something? I think we can, these last, like, 10, 15 minutes, we can talk about something like the midterm thing.
Right, yeah. So, real quick to kind of say that we've talked about the actual jurisdiction of the university, and that's been my largest kind of quibble with this, is the jurisdiction of the university, I think, should not be solely on campus, because of the nature of colleges these days is so off campus. I think that the jurisdictional part of this is problematic, but to separate that out, I actually do agree with much of the way that it governs the internal proceedings. So for instance, the accuser must be guaranteed the option to appeal under Obama's guidelines. Currently, that with the DeVos changes, both the accuser and the accused may be granted or may not be granted the option, so long as it's uniform. And then to address that that problem with the Obama guidelines that didn't allow for cross-examination, a lot of that was based on really, really shaky science that even when cross-examination was allowed, it was often discredited because the individual could claim trauma, and that science just simply isn't there to support that. And so the cross-examination process, I think, is important in these rulings. And I understand that a lot of the fear there is it's so understandable, and it's so incredibly difficult to sit here, you know, in a room of four dudes and say that you know, women who have been assaulted or harassed should have to face that accuser or that perpetrator ever again. But it's something that when we see those interactions going on in the judicial proceeding, the defendant simply doesn't have the ability to question the credibility of the evidence put against them. And oftentimes, as we talked about, there's simply not that much hard evidence in these cases, and so it will often rest on simply the testimony of the victim in that case. And so to not have the ability to actively cross-examine, I think, is something that is difficult. And so that is something that these policies do change, I think, for the better.
I think that's an interesting point that you raised, and I do have some disagreements with the last part of it, or regarding the facing the accuser, the cross-examination element of it. I think that is... we're going to have to get into
that. Yeah, I mean, one thing that I think is something I would be willing to compromise on is to at least allow cross-examination by written question is where I think it should go. I think defendants should be allowed to put forth questions after reading the testimony of the victim to the individual by written question, not requiring a confrontation. I still am for that active face-to-face.
If Bob Mueller has to give his questions to the president before he can interview him, I think that we can also have that same standard for people who
have... That's something I'm totally comfortable with.
Matthew, your final point, and then we're going to move on to just some miscellany about midterms and stuff like that.
Well, I do think it is important that we do kind of keep in line with at least the Adam Blackwell standard, right? To, you know, 'tis better that, you know, 10 guilty men go free than one innocent man should suffer. And I don't think that it's, at least from what I've seen, it's not very common that people are, but ever so occasionally it does. So I do understand why there is this kind of push to lighten up on the load that is put on the accused in this situation.
Yeah.
We're going to have to leave it there, but I just want to mention that this section of programming is brought to you by the Aereo pop-up tour. UT Austin dates are Monday 9-24 through Wednesday 9-26. More information online. And that was the plug. So we have 10 minutes left. I do want to talk about some work that we here are doing at the Order. We're working on a number of things. First of all, we're working on getting an actual podcast set up. So apart from this 1 hour of programming and the 1 hour that Wes has, the Declarations for Independence at 6 a.m. on Tuesdays.
6 a.m. on Tuesdays, indeed.
Yeah. And so we're working on getting a podcasting set up, and you can find we'll probably get that set up, hopefully.
Yeah, I'm going through the iOS application process right now, and so that should be finished within the week, and then we'll be expanding, kind of have just one big blitz of SoundCloud, iOS, we'll get on some Android services as well, TuneIn and the like, and that will be a stream for all of the subsidiary podcasts of the Texas Order, our fantastic program here, Not Fake News, as well as my program, Declarations from Independence, and potentially a few others. We will have an official order podcast where it's going to be a bit more freeform, or a bit more wide ranging. We'll have the opportunity to actually get in depth on some of the topics that were a bit rushed on the show here.
Yes, because we always have things we run out of we wanted to talk about. This week we want to talk about a story regarding Palestine, which is not really being covered, but unfortunately we just don't have time for that, because we need more than just 10 minutes to talk about it. So we're probably going to have a official podcast. You can find that on the texasorder.com probably. Uh-huh. Where we'll be talking about that. And then of course we're also working on the midterm, because the midterms are coming up, and Wes, why don't you just take it away?
Yeah, so we're doing a kind of educational project here at the Order for the midterms. We're going to take the ballot from the UT student's perspective, so a UT student registered in Austin to vote in the 2018 midterms, and so Austin's a bit difficult to do with that, because hashtag gerrymandering. We have a lot of different districts that find their corners in campus, so we're going to take those, the kind of three major ones that abut in campus or around campus. But for the other ones, it's going to be all of the local and state elections that a UT student can participate in. So we're going to do a little bit of a rundown on what the actual election is, what the role and responsibility of that office is, and who's running, what the top three issues are, and where the candidates fall on those issues. So it's really important for UT students to understand that in these local elections, your voice is so much more powerful than on the national stage or even on the state stage. The local elections have historically low participation. We're going to expect to see a bit more turnout with the up-ticket races in terms of Beto really driving Democratic support, but still, a lot of these have super low turnout, super low participation. Even if voters are voting top ticket, a lot of the times they will just ignore the bottom ballot. So it is a place where UT students can have their voice heard in a very powerful way. And so it's incumbent upon you in many ways, if you would so choose, to educate yourself. And I think it is a good thing that students participate in these local elections. I'm not suggesting that you do. I'm not commanding that you do, because that would run me afoul of the lovely FCC.
Yes, you wouldn't want Anurag to be hauled off in cuffs for that, but
Anurag enjoys short walks to the fridge and frog marches to the gulag, but not the United States prisons.
Not in my state right now.
That's true.
I have a broken foot from... Well, it's an interesting story. Story for a different day.
But, yeah.
So we were working on that. And Nick, I think we have a few minutes left. So why don't you just tell us about the next... you're part of another organization here on campus called the Texas Political Union. So what's that meeting?
Yeah, so I'm very excited to start off another semester with the Texas Political Union. On campus, we're the only nonpartisan outlet for open discussion and debate. So what we do is we meet once a week in a classroom. This year it will be JGB 2.202. That's the Jackson Geosciences Building across from the Liberal Arts Building. And we'll be meeting Monday night, 6 to 7:30. We'll be talking about social media and politics. It's a very informal atmosphere. We really just strive to get as many different viewpoints as we can all in the same room, and try to hash out some differences, try to open minds to different viewpoints. And it's great, not only if you're confident in your political views, it's a great opportunity to help your eloquence and to kind of solidify your views a little bit better. If you're not sure what you believe, it's a great opportunity as well to learn about both sides and try to find your voice. So we'll be talking about a lot of different things. Hopefully we'll be getting some faculty to come speak with us. So we'll start this Monday. social media and politics, and then we'll move into the liberal world order the week after that, and then the week after that we'll be talking about the separation of powers and if our institutions are still working the way they should be. They're not.
Yes, well, that's very interesting. And we, in fact, we had a show right before this. We're talking about social media and politics, so there is talk about that. But I want to thank everybody. I think that's our show for today, which is September 6th, apparently, which is pretty fast. My thanks to Wes, Nick, and Matthew. You can find archives of our show online at thetexasorder.com, along with Wes's show, Declarations from Independence, which you can catch on 6 a.m. on Tuesdays on 91.7 FM. You can join us next week on Not Fake News. I'm sorry. I apologize today about there was a lot of hectic, you know, scrambling for a lot of things, but hopefully next week we'll try to do better. But my name is Anurag Singh. This has been Not Fake News. And as always, take care, everybody.